This is called Privacy 2013. Three great speakers, Paul, Eric and Nick. This is also the controversial subject generally, so I should be very interested in how this goes. Straight over to Phil.
Okay. Thank you very much. Some of you may, shall I stand up or whatever?
Yeah, go on.
Okay,
yeah.
Why not? So some of you may know me from previous open text. I used to coordinate Noto ID, the campaign against ID cards and the database state. MedConfidential is a new campaign founded by a number of privacy organisations fighting a live fight, as you will see during my presentation, for patient privacy. The reason why I've got a question mark after that is, and you may agree after this presentation, we don't think there is patient privacy in the NHS in 2013.
Is there any doubt?
They are coming for your data. Last December, David Cameron made a speech on life sciences and stimulating economic activity in the UK, saying that they were going to consult, they have now done that, and changed the NHS constitution. The default now, in England at least, is that every single patient is a research patient by default, unless, of course, they wish to opt out. Those opt-outs, however, which have been promised not just by Mr. Cameron, but also by Secretary of State Jeremy Hunt, are yet to emerge. This is a headline from yesterday. It's a headline we hoped not to see anytime soon, but we're checking the provenance of it. But the NHS England, as you will come to realise, is a new body, a new quango, that is running the NHS in England. It used to be called the NHS Commissioning Board, and its explicit goal is to extract data directly from your GP-held medical records for a range of purposes, those that roughly come under the banner of commissioning purposes, things that aren't to do with your direct medical care, and some of which are to do with stimulating economic activity. As I say, we hope not to see this headline because no one yet has been told what is going on. Patients do not know about the opt-outs which Mr. Cameron said last December, which Mr. Hunt said at the end of April. And if patients don't know they have a choice, it's no choice at all. This is all coming from a major re-engineering of the NHS under what's something called the Health and Social Care Act 2012, a law that's already been passed. And this re-engineering is for the explicit purpose of making more data flow around and beyond the NHS. We're talking about the merging of two sectors, not just the health service and the health sector, but the social care sector as well. So we're seeing initiatives such as, for example, and those of you who I imagine are highly technically competent in this room will understand, the use of the NHS number as a unique identifier anywhere apart from inside the NHS starts to look very much like the old ID scheme that we were getting rid of. A single number to be able to link together all of your records wherever they may be. Okay? So we're talking about a serious re-engineering. You don't have to worry about these two next slides. This was the old NHS under the structure. This is the simplified NHS. Okay? That's too complicated. What we need to know about is what are the data flows? And there are a lot of acronyms in the NHS, as any of you who know the health sector will realise. Just to give you a bit of an overview, this is the Commissioning Board. They've rebranded themselves NHS England because it sounds a lot more friendly. This is something called the Health and Social Care Information Centre. This is a body which pre-existed the NHS and which actually was formed to hold the World War II ID cards and census data. So it's from this body that everyone's NHS numbers were originally issued, and this body has largely speaking sat on the side of things, chugged through aggregate data, statistics, and handled population level data very efficiently for several generations. It's now changed. As of the 1st of April this year, it is now the central hub through which all identifiable patient data will flow. Well, in theory. This is you down here, your GP. Your GP maybe has computers at their own practice. It may have computers, or it may store your data on local server farms. There are all sorts of regional bodies, things called a Data Management Integration Centre. There are about 10 of these. They were not created in law, they're just bodies that happen to exist. They've been conveniently attached to this information centre by just seconding to staff. These things were, we've got documentation from last year that shows these things were unlawful for processing personal data. Similarly, over here, the commissioning board has all of its various bodies down at local area team level, something called commissioning support units. Again, this commissioning process, that's sort of all the profiling, monitoring, performance monitoring, predicting, reconciling invoices, and all that sort of stuff. And then down to these bodies, which I think many people will have heard of, which are these local clinical commissioning groups, which have GP representation on, but which are the replacement for what used to be called primary care trusts. There is also a sort of grayed out bit. There's other bits of public health going on in your local authority. So, I've highlighted those three because we're going to focus on one particular flow. The one particular flow that I want to talk about now is something called the General Practice Extraction Service. This is your GP. This is your medical record as you understand it, which is held by your GP. Your GP is the data controller of your medical record. That is held on your GP's systems, or the systems which your GP has contracted. But now, a new device, and some of you who are aware of things which I think Nick might be talking about, comms data, the idea of a request filter going and sucking up data from where it's held, well, they've got one of those. Something called the GPES query tool, built by ATOS, sits at the information centre, sends down a request to an extraction tool, which runs a request over the GP's data and sucks it back up and can do so in identifiable form. The commissioning board basically tells information centre, and because of the law that was passed last year, the information centre can require your GP to disclose that data. Your GP will have no choice. Okay? There is some oversight from the work of these people. They've tried to hold this request back, but it has now been approved. This request, so what do we mean? What do we mean? They're sending down this request, down the wire. What's it going to mean to you or me or anyone? What we're talking about is a list at the moment of over 100 bullet-pointed data sets of all sorts of conditions and treatments and diagnoses. Those treatments, or those bullet-point data sets, the sort of top-level name for it, convert down into something called read codes. Every single event inside the NHS is coded. Yeah? So those hundreds of data sets break down into thousands of read codes. That request is sent down that pipe and brings back up millions of items of data. Those items of data all associated with what, as you can see, is a list of identifiers. This is identifiable personal data. They don't dispute that. So, what's the problem? Well, the request that we managed to get, the GPS independent advisory group managed to kick back, has forced them to limit what they're doing in the first instance. So for the first release, the first version of this, when the data goes up identifiably, they say the outputs will not be identifiable. Unfortunately, we're not talking about them truly anonymizing data, we're talking about pseudonymization and de-identification. Hopefully this audience is one of the more technically competent, so I don't have to explain what that means. Also, just to give you a sense of perspective, this care.dot data, this single sort of request of hundreds of data sets, thousands of read codes, millions of items of data going up, is just one data flow. Data flows from all over the rest of the NHS and from practices in many other ways to the information centre. And, I'm afraid, it's not even as simple as that. There are powers, legal exemptions, and one called Section 251 of the NHS Act 2006 permits the commissioning board, or will permit the commissioning board, to take, pass around, and process data in identifiable form. Yeah. So even though, if you may hear people claim that this is going to be passed around only in anonymised form, by which they mean something else, know also that they are passing this around in identifiable form, because there is no other reason why you would apply for a Section 251 exemption. Yeah? They've already got one of these, because when they abolished the primary care trusts, they made themselves unlawful. but they're applying for a blanket exemption to pass around your data, everyone's data in England, in identifiable form for commissioning and secondary purposes. Second headline of today, it's not just that they're talking about passing around this data, they are selling it. Okay, they're selling it to private firms. This is an article that's in today's Guardian. We've been working on it for some time. We've identified not just the price lists, but the actual spreadsheets that they give out to, for you to calculate how much it's going to cost you to purchase patient data for a whole range of different sort of subsets. And the sorts of fees that we are talking about, frankly, are trivial, if you can see. So over here, we've got inpatient data, outpatient data. This might have things like mental health, psychiatric episodes, live stillbirth information, we've got critical care data, A&E data. ONS is as you think, it's the Office of National Statistics. PROMS is patient recorded outcome measures. SUS is secondary uses service and payment by results. So we have a process already in place by which it's been engineered for medical research within the academy, essentially for universities and university hospitals. This is now being used to sell to private companies. Yeah? The headline, if I just quickly go back today, was that it's Bupa basically buying your records, but there are other companies as well. So I will quickly shove this slide up for those who aren't aware. Re-identification of the sort of data that they're talking about passing around is not trivial, but it is increasingly easy, and it is being done. Okay? And with large data sets in a big data world, it is relatively easy, especially if you're outside an urban area, with very few reference points, to start to get down to very small numbers of people, if not actual individuals. There's a particular problem with medical databases, is that so much of this information, which makes it useful, is the very stuff that can help you, again, to winnow down very rapidly to small numbers or individuals. So, for example, the example we've got there, a 42-year-old woman with a 9-year-old daughter, both of whom have psoriasis. You're probably talking about a handful of people in the population. Yeah? And once you add in other information about, as I say, about sort of location or what have you, you're into individuals. Also, because everyone's healthcare or health pathway or your health, the health episodes that you go through are so unique, if you tend to link these into what are called longitudinal records, most patients can be uniquely identified by the circumstances and things that happen to them through their lives. Once you start adding in demographic and family data, it becomes worse. Once you start adding in some of the social networky stuff that we're starting to see happen around health data, that gets worse still. And ultimately and explicitly, the government is going to try to link this to sequenced DNA, which frankly, I imagine I don't have to explain why that's a problem in this room. And it's not just the naive idea of a hacker attack or an outside attack we're talking about. This is the number of people who have been issued an NHS smart card. That NHS smart card gives you access to NHS systems such as the Personal Demographics Service. That's the NHS's internal sort of address book or lookup book. And you can see from that, if you have details about someone, and it does get used, unfortunately, in this way, you can look them up on PDS and find all sorts of details, including the ones in red, which obviously are clearly identifiable, and other sensitive information or indications of sensitive data in their record. So I'll wrap up very quickly, which I'd like to ask you, we're a new campaign, and I would like to ask you three things. Number one, if any of you in your work do happen to come across or be asked to process health data, to work on health applications or what have you, please, please, please do check the provenance and, importantly, the consent that has been gathered for this information. Yeah? There's a lot of data, there's a lot of hack days going on at the moment where there's properly treated statistical or aggregate data, but we are going to increasingly see data that has been gathered without people's consent being used or being applied to this field. The other one is, please do inform yourself and inform others. We're a new campaign, but we'll be getting a newsletter out shortly. There will be more, obviously, in this in the media and on our website. And if you do have concerns, please tell other people and please do exercise your right to opt out. And finally, just a straightforward appeal, we need help. Skills and time, very, very gratefully received, as we're a new, young campaign, and obviously we're trying to get sort of as big an impact as we can, as quickly as we can. I'll just end on this final number. That is the number of patients that NHS England, the commissioning board, has informed, as of today, about what's going on. That's ridiculous. You all in this room now know more than the best part of the rest of the population about what's going on. Thank you very much.
Does anybody have a mini display port?
If not, I'll just talk. No one to the rescue. Maybe one person to the rescue?
Are we able to ask questions about...
Oh, look at this. Fantastic. Never worked first time. Quite amazing. Very interesting stuff from Phil, and I'm not going to be talking about anything at all kind of specific to us. I'm going to be talking about surveillance technology and surveillance technology that the UK and other Western democracies are exporting to regimes around the world. I run a project at Privacy International called Big Brother Incorporated, where for the last 2 years we've been investigating these companies. We've been identifying the tools that are on sale, and the governments that are buying it. When I began this project 2 years ago, the question that I was trying to answer was, if you're a human rights defender in Yemen, and you need to send some sensitive information to a client, can you do so securely? And if there's a choice of which medium to use, a text message, a phone call, and an email, which should you select? Now, unfortunately, we are nowhere near further in answering that question, but there's been the journey's been kind of very interesting. We now have a much better idea about what's on the market and some of the potential, and I hope that in maybe 10 years we might be able to get a little bit further. So for the last 2 years I've been going to surveillance trade shows and arms fairs around the world.
I want a tank.
Why do you want a tank? You can get a gold plated submachine gun. That's what's amazing. So this was the gold-plated submachine gun was actually sold in London. And while I wasn't allowed to purchase it there and then, the guy said if I wanted to meet him in a hotel room afterwards, he might be able to sort something out. And so here's a Predator drone. You've got a lovely tank, a gold-plated submachine gun. Now, this is a particularly fun bit of kit, which I do not know how it works. And if anyone here can tell me, you're gods to me. So this is a directional microphone, right? It's a parabolic microphone. You just point in the direction. We all know how those things work. But then, what you can see here is that there's a little dial, and there's a controller on it. And what you can do is you're pointing it, and you hold it like a gun, of course. And you can dial it down. So if I'm pointing it over here, you dial down the dial, and it reduces the range of the microphone. So if I was pointing it here, I could listen to the conversation at the back of the room, moving forward, moving forward, moving forward. Again, all kind of maybe all right. But this is what's crazy. It didn't require line of sight for itself. So I could be pointing it through four walls, and it would still be getting some kind of audio back to me. I don't know how that works. I was expecting some kind of, maybe a laser bouncing off a couple of things and it's working out some reflections. Something along those lines, but as I was playing with it, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. Nevertheless, the point remains, they sell scary stuff at these things. This is a These are trade shows, as you might understand trade shows. They've still got girls wearing bikinis, but this time they're sitting on tanks. Or in the case of surveillance technology, they're sitting on servers. Depending on your interests. Now, again, for people that follow surveillance or are interested in this as a topic, none of this is going to be necessarily mind-blowingly new. For me, what's really interesting about this as an area is understanding the commercialization of this. You know, we can understand the academic threats, we can understand potentially what could be happening, but it's a very, very different thing to see a product being sold in a certain way to certain customers and those product pitches. For me, that's what really hits home. And you can see just a couple of examples here that I'm going to go through. You've got voice recognition. Now, I mean, I don't know how well this stuff works, but and that's a trend throughout all of this technology, is that we all know that this stuff doesn't work perfectly. Of course it doesn't. But if it does 60% of the job, it's saving a lot of human time. And that's where this stuff, where the automation, the processing, the mass processing of this stuff gets really worrying for me. And the trend means, of course, it's only going to get better. Here, this is a company, a US company called Packet Forensics, who sell a SSL man-in-the-middle box that they sold it as perfect for installing in a left-leaning university. I thought that was quite cute. And then down here, this is a, I can't remember which company this is. Oh no, this is Amasys. This is a French company that got caught selling mass surveillance technology to Libya. And it just gives you a bit of an idea, and I think it really drives home some of what Phil was saying as well, because whereas we think of, as we kind of move around the world, as we do our day-to-day tasks, we, you know, sometimes hand over bits of data, or as Privacy International likes to think of it, we're allowing access to our data. We still feel that it is ours. But it's all discrete. You log into a hotel and there's some data there. You go to your doctor and there's some data there. And what this vigilance system does very, very plainly is that it collects it all together into a centralized monitoring center. And this is a product that's now been sold to, I believe, 90 countries around the world. And you can just see, I'm afraid it's not perfect quality here, but you'll be able to read. Oh, I'm not going to be able to, am I? You've got tactical operations. You've got your basic PTSN call here. You've got bank information up here. You've got location from GSM cell towers and a whole range of other things. They get pulled together into these central locations. So I'm going to touch on three technologies very, very briefly. IMSI catchers are tactical boxes. We've got a couple showing here that show they're kind of the size of a desktop box, but actually they're about the size of your fist now. You can buy them very, very cheaply. And they're fake cell towers. They're fake mobile phone base stations. And they mask and send out signals as if they are legitimate mobile phone base stations. And what happens is, if I had one in this room, for example, I'd press the first switch, and it would tell me the IMSI, which is the International Mobile Subscriber Identifier, which is on your SIM card, of every single person in the radius that I set via the dial that I have. And that radius is basically determined by how big your battery is. And so you can imagine straight away that the idea of a police officer needing to, say, ask papers, please, or can I have your ID card, becomes a very analog idea, given that everyone carries a mobile phone. The next switch you press on the IMSI catcher says, right, I know exactly which person I want to look at. Phil. He's looked like he's up to no good. So I want to find out everything that he's up to. Well, on this box that I've got here, I can focus in on his IMSI, and I can force all of the traffic that he's sending out to go through me. And it's at that point which I can read all the SMS messages, listen to the phone calls. And most of these devices can do about 30 channels simultaneously, and you record 29 and listen to one. Now, amazingly, oh, have we got that slide? That'd be good if we do. Oh, yeah, here you go. Great. And so why would you use this if you're a state? Well, you can deploy it without the cooperation of a network provider, which means that you're, in other ways, you're getting around potentially laws that might require certain authorizations. You can use it by yourself without having to say, hey, Vodafone, I'd like you to do X, Y, and Z, which requires a certain process. Maybe someone in Vodafone might want to kick back against this. So that's how they sell this. They also talk about overseas development, because, of course, this isn't just you using it against your own citizens as a state. You might want to go to another country and deploy it there. And Here we go. We've got it. La la la. This is my favourite bit. Active systems can send spoof SMS messages to the target for misinformation purposes. So, the police are coming behind you! Gets changed into definitely go backwards. And this is technology sold by a British company called Cobham, and was sold to Tunisia, and this technology was deployed during the pro-democracy protests there during the revolution. And of course, as a result, you can also find very fine-grained locational information, particularly if you have more than one, where you can do triangulation. Very, very similar process, but for satellite phone interception. A number of human rights activists and journalists use satellite phones when they're working in risky regions, and it is trivial to intercept satellite phones. It's very, very affordable. I should say an IMSI catcher you can buy for about £250, and you can build one yourself for a lot less. Satellite phone interception works in exactly the same way, and you can see there that you can cover not just your country, but an entire range of countries as well. So again, we're still talking about stuff that's a little bit tactical, but I wonder if we can go up a notch. Let's go to the mass surveillance scale. So over the last 2 years, we've collected about 300 brochures, I think, at this point. And I did a very, very quick study. I searched within the brochures for mass or nationwide. And here are a couple of quotes that we came at. This is ClearTrail, an Indian company, who say that they have expertise in countrywide monitoring. Utamaco, a British-German company, say that they can do mass interception to monitor all calls and messages. Telesoft, capable of mass capture of entire countrywide wireline telecommunications networks. And my personal favourite, a South African company called Vastek, who claimed that they can intercept more than 100,000 phone calls simultaneously, allowing it to capture up to 1 billion intercepts a day. And this is technology that's been sold to Libya and was used to great effect during the revolution there. I think this slide sums it up. Is mass surveillance even possible? Well, why sample when you can monitor everything inexpensively? And that's really where we've got to, I'm afraid. And then you get onto the big guns. I'm sorry I'm flying through this, but I figure you guys would be interested. Submarine cable landing station. 95% of the world's communications flow through fibre optic undersea cables. And you can intercept them, says this company. And they helpfully explain it. You can get access to Gmail, your Yahoo Mail, your Facebook. And this was last year, so this is including HTTPS. This is how they do it. They split everything out. They basically bend the cable, and they get 10%, 20% of the light flowing through it, and then you can do whatever you want. And here you go. So you can pull out your chat detail record. This is from Facebook, your profile, image, username, ID. I've blurred out some of these, but actually these are all real interceptions that they've used as part of it. And this is how they show it. This is how surveillance companies see Facebook. I mean, we always kind of say that, you know, Facebook is the most effective CIA program that was ever in existence. But, you know, it really kind of hits home, even for me, who looks at this stuff day in, day out, when you see surveillance companies pitching this technology to repressive regimes and the use that Facebook has. I'm going to skip that. Siemens. Were a world leader. They've been providing this sort of technology. They've been providing intelligent solutions and monitoring centres for the last 15, 20 years. And when I started this, I was trying to work out why Siemens, why do they have so much capacity to do this? And then I realised that they'd hired all the ex-Stasi officers. And this is some of my favourite marketing of this. This is a panther on the motherboard. Always a successful marketing campaign. Of course, what's not a little bit less funny is that they sold this to Iran, and this was used to target dissidents and pro-democracy activists over a long time. This was a presentation from 2007. I'm not sure what time did Twitter kick off? Around then, you know. So this is old, but nevertheless, it can get a report within minutes to track all major contact people of the main militant group in the country, or in the case of Iran, people that want their rights. Again, data integration sources, data analysis, DNA databases, fingerprint databases, telephone billing records, telephone book. data retention systems, bank account transactions, driving license registered, traffic control points, everything that you think of as discrete and separate, and there's absolutely no one collecting this all into one place and tying it together. Well, Siemens, since at least 2007, have been providing these solutions for to at least 85 countries around the world that do, unfortunately, exactly that. And this is, again, to give you a time frame on how good this is. So that's 21 million, is that right? Call records that they could crunch in about an hour. I'm sure that's probably down to about 2 minutes now. And you can fill whatever queries that you want. Now, I'm just going to do one final thing. I know that I'm coming up to time, but I wanted to show you a particular video.
Oh my god, it's PowerPoint.
Don't. It's bad enough that to use it once. Alright, here you go.
Play.
Don't worry about the music. You're just missing some kind of like soft porn.
Put the mic on it. Put the mic on the speaker.
Oh yeah, there you go. So this is a British company who sell this technology. And this is your internet service provider. And this is what the rooms look like, for those of you who don't know, of course. And you plug a box into the network.
And a Plutz t-shirt.
Now, I'm sure you guys know that it doesn't quite work this way, but it's not that off the mark for these purposes.
They don't have to do that.
So they're DPIing everything on the network. You connect at home, and they send you a fake iTunes update. At which point you're infected with their government Trojan, allowing them full access to your system, including, of course, all your Skype calls, every keystroke that you press, every file that you adjust, anything that's encrypted on your drive is, of course, no longer really encrypted because they've got access to it there. And this is technology that's been sold to not 25, 35 countries around the world now. And this is exported from the UK. A lot of these technologies are exported from the UK. They're exported from Europe, primarily the UK and Germany. And the point that I really want to get to with this is that I hope you all feel that this is wrong. This isn't okay. And that we don't want to be supporting this. And British businesses shouldn't be creating this. And European businesses shouldn't be building these sorts of technologies. But there's a question about what to do. Now, for me, the policy solution to this is to introduce export controls. Now, for many of us who have been in this space for a long time, export controls are a bad thing. It doesn't sit well, the idea that you can limit the export of certain things. The crypto wars was something the Privacy International spent about 10 or 15 years of their early existence fighting against. But I think that this technology can be fixed. Sorry, not cannot be fixed. Can be controlled by export controls. Not 100%, not completely effectively, but it can do some good. As we all know, export controls on arms don't work perfectly. Bad states still get access to this stuff, but it doesn't do a bad job. It cuts out 10%, 20%, 80%. Pick your margin, it does something. And what's incredibly important at this point is that something is done. Because at this stage, these companies are exporting with impunity. There is nothing that they are doing that is legally wrong. I spent 2 years trying to hold these companies to account, and they have not broken any laws straightforwardly. One of the companies, Gamma International, have exported this technology to 35 countries around the world, and we're now having to fight them on whether or not they used controlled cryptography as part of their systems. And it seems as if they have, and as a result, they have actually breached export control laws. And Privacy International is now in a position where we are having to say that these guys should be prosecuted because they've exported cryptography. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right. And we need better export control laws. targeted at surveillance technology that will be effective and comprehensive. The intellectual basis is there. The information is now available. We can do this. What it requires is that when we push, when we go to government and ask for this, we don't get a pushback from us, from the tech community saying this stuff is wrong. And I'd be more than happy to speak to anyone that has concerns about this. Find me over the next whatever. I'll be here and to talk this through a little bit further. But there you go. Thank you very much.
I haven't got a PowerPoint, don't worry about it. Sorry I was late. My name's Nick Pickles. I run Big Brother Watch. Some of you may have been unfortunate enough to see me on television. I think I've spent the past year of my life working on the Communications Data Bill, which wasn't a bill, then was a bill, then was a draft bill, now isn't a bill. And no one's really quite sure what's going on. We haven't had any public statements from the Home Office. So what I want to do briefly is just to run through where I think we are, where the policy is at, how you can get involved and help shape the next step in this debate, which it feels like we've been having for a while now. I think something that will cut across all the talks is there have been moments where we thought this had gone away, and then strangely we've ended up talking about ID cards or, you know, surveillance technology that's doing things that we thought we'd stopped doing in the 90s. So I think the first point is the Queen's speech. Now, as entertaining as it was to hear Her Majesty say, tackling cyberspace crime and tracing internet protocol data, which I'm assuming was the main reason it was in the speech, was because someone wanted the Queen to say it, is ridiculously that was the position in 2008 when the Home Office ran a consultation on the implementation of the Data Retention Directive. And the Home Office itself chose not to include IP data in the implementation because there were serious technical concerns and there were cost concerns. So it didn't happen. So basically, we spent the past 5 years arguing about a decision that originally the Home Office actually agreed with us on, which was this isn't really technically workable. The problem has been is that we've had a blind debate. And I don't think that helps anybody, actually. Because then you have, on the one hand, people making suggestions that the technology will read your emails, which was wrong. But because we didn't have anything written down, it was very difficult to say we won't. So you had a false debate, which led to some even within the sort of civil society community, some very strange conversations because, well, people said one thing, we didn't think it was true, but we had nothing written down, so we didn't know, and everyone got very confused. And it made us look fragmented. But it also meant when the actual bill was being worked on, nobody knew what questions to ask. So when I gave evidence to Parliament, we still didn't know the data types that were actually missing, that were being talked about. And then when I went back to give evidence, we still didn't know. And it was only very late in the process where, because the bill was being heavily criticised from all corners, that the question of what is the problem you need to fix actually got an answer. And we got told it's network address, port address data, web logs, and third party. So I think it's nothing emphatic. So I think we made an incredibly good argument on third party data collection. I think the way that the PI particularly were able to put that in the context of take this model and apply it to a different government, it suddenly sounds a lot less fine, works very well. We won that argument. And I think actually at the committee we won the argument on weblogs as well. I think the committee were very clear that they hadn't bought the argument about weblogs. So now we're having a debate, which is the debate we should have had originally but didn't do, of how to solve the IP address problem. Now, there's one question which is, do we want to solve that? And then if we do want to solve that, can it be done in a way that respects privacy? And can it be done in a technically feasible way? Now, there are suggestions that yes, it can be done in a privacy-friendly way if you are prepared to write a big enough cheque. And in the current climate, the government really isn't in the position to hand out blank cheques. So there's either a desire to do a shortcut or perhaps a desire to actually find a different way of working, which was, I think Privacy International and Big Brother Watch were unique, actually, in the civil society organisations
to actually give evidence to the committee, not just on why the bill was bad, but on here are other things that could have been done to massively improve the way that the police can catch criminals online. And I don't have a problem making it easier for the police to catch criminals online, but let's have that discussion, not can we have a blank check to do anything we want on the internet and cover everybody just in case. So we've actually got to go back to what is the problem. So we have it where we are. The government hasn't set a timescale, the Home Office haven't set a timescale, so there is an opportunity for us as a community to actually take the lead and say, well, here are the obstacles you have. If you can't meet these obstacles, then you have the same situation you had with the bill. It's not proportionate and it's not respectful of people's privacy. Or we can say, here are the areas where you have a problem. And I know from talking to lots of people, there's a real concern that police in particular don't have the skills to use the data they already have. And actually, if you talk to some of the communication companies, they have data the police never ask for. So you've got this disconnect there, which we can fix without legislation, and in a way that doesn't require huge amounts of data to be logged about millions of innocent people. So I want us to actually take that lead. And I think something that civil society has been guilty of in past debates about this is to say it's dead, we've won, and walk away. And then it comes back in 3 years' time, and we're all outraged it's come back. But actually, if the underlying thing that was causing it in the first place is still there, that's kind of inevitable. So I think this is the time where it's the third time we've killed this bill. Let's get on the front foot. Let's actually talk about the issues that we know are there now. And if it can be done, let's work with government. If it can't be done, then let's tell them why not. We don't have a situation, and I think the hardest thing about these kind of campaigns is we do not have a parliament that is blessed with technological people. And we don't have a media that is blessed with lots of people who understand tech. So we are the people who can explain, and I don't necessarily include myself in that, you are the people who have the expertise to help Parliament, to help the media understand these challenges. And sometimes we are very, very bad as a community of saying, here's the general big picture. And we jump right into the detail. And if we can actually take a step back, I think we can do some real good, whether that's reviewing data retention as it stands, massively improving the oversights. There are some things that will need legislation. I think updating RIPA would be a very, very good idea, but it has to be done with the right process. And if there isn't a process from the government side, then we can come up with a process. So there's a meeting next week of all the civil society groups. That meeting is hopefully going to come up with a roadmap to say, how do we get everybody involved? Actually, I digress. Anyone who's been in those meetings knows it's going to come up with that roadmap, and if it's only me doing it, then whatever. But there will be a roadmap for you to get involved in. Then let's look at the questions. And if we can do it, fine, let's talk, because government isn't going to suddenly just stop looking at this. They might wait 2 years and then do it again with a different government, because the officials are still there. So let's actually engage with the question. And then that has to come with some pretty hard questions. And this is also a very, very good opportunity for us as civil society to review the campaigns that we've run. And I think one thing that really worries me, and I said this last week and was kind of talked down by other civil society people, but I'm from Yorkshire, so I'll say it again, because they're not here. We didn't win the argument on technology. We didn't win the argument on feasibility, on human rights, on privacy. Basically, Nick Clegg killed this to get with them some brownie points back after secret courts, and it was a political victory. And my worry is, that was the easy route. But if we want to genuinely change the conversation that government has with its citizens about technology, and about the way that it can be used to monitor people, but also the way that it can be used to protect people's privacy, to protect human rights activists in developing countries who we want to help as a government, actually let's try and grab that mantle, and rather than just saying no, we're then moving on to the next campaign because something else has come along, as it inevitably will, actually changing the conversation to be one about these are the values we want as a society, and here are the challenges that exist now, and here's how you solve those challenges, because this is not going to go away as an issue. Cybercrime, whether you believe the numbers that have been put out there or not, is an issue. Internet security, internet privacy are going to keep coming back. and politicians will inevitably want to write laws about them. And if we're not part of that conversation before they write the law, and if all that happens is it gets written in Whitehall and then plonked on a table, and then we all feed in saying this is utter rubbish again, well, that doesn't help anybody, because we keep going around a cycle, and inevitably one or two bad bits of law will get through. And so listen out for how you can get involved. Come talk to me, email me, tweet me, whatever. But do get involved in how we take this forward, so we don't get a situation like the Digital Economy Act, where everybody in the civil society has a million and one arguments why this is a bad idea and it's not going to work, and nobody outside of civil society hears us. And you end up talking inwards. And I think this is the time when civil society can talk out and say, people are listening because people want to know what the discussion is. Why was everyone outraged about the Snippers Charter? That's the time to have the conversation, because people are asking, what was wrong? Why is it dead? Why didn't Bitcoin kill it? What should we do instead? Isn't terrorism on the internet a bad thing? We should stop it. Now, here's the time where we can change the debate. So help us change the debate away from being one which is just being against things, and actually help us put forward a positive view of our rights, our freedoms, online and offline, so that when this comes back next time, it either works, which would be a surprise, but would be nuts, or it doesn't come back at all. And that's where we need to be, rather than just having the same old fights. If for no other reason that it does keep several people employed, I want a holiday. And that's kind of all it is, so I'll finish there.
Thanks, Andy.